History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And really, they don't have to go untold if folks like you and I are willing to take a little time, ask a few questions, and patiently listen while remarkable memories start to emerge from the shadows. Our aim is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. You're going to meet a 98-year-old Purple Heart recipient today, but before we get to Don Pullen's story, I want you to hear about the place that led me to him. The Fort Douglas Military Museum in Salt Lake City, Utah. It was an active base until about 30 years ago, and so many of those buildings are still standing. Fort Douglas was actually named by President Abraham Lincoln in honor of his old political rival, Stephen Douglas. That's just one thing I had a chance to learn there, but there are generations worth of history to digest. I have some photos and video up for you at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, but let's learn a little more right now about this special place from the museum's director, Beau Burgess.
So the Fort Douglas Military Museum is Utah's officially recognized military history museum, as well as repository. So we have stuff from all over the world, international, national, but primarily with our existence in this particular community is to tell the Utah military story. So the military in Utah and those Utahns who have served and are still serving in the military currently.
What kind of time period does the history here, the artifacts here, the narratives here, what kind of time period are we talking about historically?
So our artifacts, the collections are a lot more comprehensive, but primarily with our focus in the active exhibits is primarily 1850s, which is like the Utah War, on up. Primarily, though, it focuses up through World War II heavily, and then there's some stuff from Korea, Vietnam, Desert Storm, Gulf War era after that. But that's primarily our main emphasis is 1850s on up.
I'm sure you've experienced this a few times because, I mean, this is here so people learn things they didn't know before. But you're probably privy to things that people are surprised by. And I'm sure you've seen some reactions to different things. Is there an exhibit or two or an artifact or two that you find gets a lot of attention or has people saying, hey, I didn't know that, or wow?
Yeah, so a time ago, we still have in our collections, our holdings, Saddam Hussein's boots, his kind of last pair of boots. Our Utah National Guard was involved in that operation, and we're allowed to bring some stuff home as souvenirs and presented some stuff to the White House and brought some stuff here to the museum. So that's something that people will still show up because it's posted on the internet to come and see those at the museum. However, currently they're on display in an offsite exhibit, but they are part of our collection. As of more recent, we have a exhibit that was put up that talks about the history of parachutes in Utah. So kind of the Rosies and the parachute factories, and then them going overseas and being used to jump out of airplanes in the war effort, and then being brought back home as souvenirs. And so we currently have two wedding dresses from World War II, just post-World War II, when we had all the shortages that are on display in the museum. So that gets a lot of wows because people don't think, oh, wedding dresses in a military museum? But when you realize something like World War II, one of these last great world-consuming of materials and material culture, metal and silk and nylon and all these things that went into that particular war effort, it's definitely something that shows you the impact of war is just beyond fighting on the battlefront.
Have you had anybody come through and say, hey, I got married in a parachute wedding dress, or someone said, hey, my wife was in a parachute wedding dress when we got married?
You know, I personally haven't spoken with anybody directly that wore one, but sons and daughters have come through and said, oh, hey, my grandma or my mom or, you know, so-and-so had a parachute wedding dress. We actually had somebody come through the other day and said, I think the governor of Utah's mom or grandma worked in the parachute factory here in Utah too. They should come see this exhibit. So it's interesting just how widespread I think most people would have a family member or a family friend that has served in the military in some capacity. But I think being in a place, a museum where the history took place, is quite eye-opening when you get veterans and people that served here on the home front as well, civilians during the war with all those efforts that come in and they say, hey, did you know this? Or hey, I have the story. Or hey, this is something maybe you might want to check out, because we're in a place where the history happened. And so the visitors come in and they are part of that history. So we continue to try to collect these stories from our visitors as well.
Why do you think it's important that people know this kind of history that you guys preserve and celebrate here?
I think definitely military history, because it's so far-reaching, all different places in the world. I mean, of course, now we've got not necessarily military, but it's part of the branches is the Space Force as well. So essentially, it's really far-reaching. Having people come in, I think, that don't know that we have like a bug exhibit or parachutes or recycling exhibit. So I think really kind of importance and reach is just that military history pretty much touches everything, all eras of military history and all facets of life. So to come into a museum and say, okay, here's battlefront stuff, here's military issued stuff, but then also, okay, here's home front stuff. Here's the way it affected somebody that was 10 or 3. Here's the way it affected like a teenage girl in the middle of kind of nowhere Utah in the 1940s, that she would get up on a bus and ride 3 hours to make parachutes for a war that she was touched by directly and massively in her life, but she didn't quite understand the whole concept because she's in a small town where they get a newspaper from another town over a week late. So it's a kind of a disconnect, but it's a direct connection to just how far reaching military history is. You know, it's a lot to take in, but I guess kind of in a nutshell, it's just so far reaching. That's why it's important, especially when you are designated as being the state's main repository and place to tell that. So we do have other military history museums, but not all encompassing like we are with all eras, all branches of service.
And specific to the World War II era, is there an item in your collection that you're particularly proud of, or do you think people get the most out of?
Yeah, so for World War II history, I mean, personally, I'm intrigued. We have a World War II ambulance. It's not always out on display because it's fully restored and operational. The famous Sherman tank, which we have more rare version of it, which is kind of part cast, part welded, that a lot of people come in and take a look at. That's always just iconic. Mm-hmm. Especially where most of us, especially now with changing military operations and the way we do war, I guess, and defense, we just don't get to see those things up close and personal. So to see on a daily basis, people come and say, oh my gosh, look at how big this is. But then that reverse, this is a huge machine, but you think, oh, it's like a school bus. There's got to be like 30, 40 people in there. It's like, get inside of it and you can see it's a lot of metal and some other things, but there's a couple of people in there. That's about it. There's military issued stuff, and then there's stuff that's brought home, souvenirs of war of different veterans, and then there's stateside stuff. But another fun one that we have that I like to tell people is we have Hitler's head in our collection. It's a joke. You think of it's like Hitler's head in a jar, but it's a little bust of Hitler's head that was brought home as a souvenir of war. And it's just got this great story or this provenance behind it of this tenant being harassed by her landlord and kind of going into the military and saying, hey, please help me stop this. They interrogate the guy. He goes out and buries all the evidence in the backyard. She goes out, digs it up, and one of the things is this Hitler propaganda sculpture head, and presenting that back to those guys. Those guys give it to another family. It comes here to America. It comes here to this museum. So there's definitely a lot of intriguing items in the collection. And of course, some of them come with ghost stories as well. So kind of a fun thing.
Yeah, I've heard about the ghost stories. And, you know, a lot of people, when it comes to museums, they evaluate a museum based on its gift shop. I understand your gift shop even has some items that are handcrafted by World War II veterans.
Yes, definitely. So one of our feature items that we have currently in our gift shop is a series of cutting boards handcrafted by Don Pullen. And Don is a World War II veteran. Utah veteran. He was a D-Day plus four, I think Utah Beach actually. And hopefully you'll be able to chat with him at some point here. But he's closing in on 100 years old. He had seen some pretty amazing and at the same time horrific things with D-Day, with war in general, with concentration camps, death camps. One unique thing about Don is he actually photographed a lot of the war on a camera he wasn't supposed to have. So everybody would buy and smuggle and find film and dish it off to him, and he'd take photographs for everybody. So he's got a lot of World War II documented on these photographs. But Don, he's alone now, of course, living to 100. A lot of people pass on before you. Mm-hmm. And so he has his little companion, Lily, his little dog. And to kind of pass the time and have a creative outlet, I think also deal a little bit with some of his PTSD as well. He makes these handmade cutting boards. So he gets the plastic and gets them cut and manufactures them and sands them. And then he finds different images that he likes, a lot of them being patriotic or holiday themed. And he'll reverse paint those and scale them. And that's what he spends a lot of his time doing. So we're one of those outlets to help him, you know, occupy his time, have a creative outlet, heal from some of his PTSD and be able to cope with that. And yeah, he sells those here at our gift shop, and all the money that we get from those goes back into buying more plastic and paints and all that stuff. So he doesn't charge his time. It's just literally to cover his cost.
Anything else you think we should know about the museum?
The Fort Douglas Military Museum is open Tuesdays through Saturdays, noon to 5. We are a free public museum. We're under the Utah National Guard and the Center of Military History. And we're located on the University of Utah campus here in Salt Lake City, Utah. And definitely come up, see the museum. We have a lot of indoor exhibits, again, spanning all areas of Utah and territorial Utah history. 1840s is when the Mormons, the pioneers, came out. And so 1850s on up. There's something here in the museum for everybody. Like I said, we've got parachute wedding dresses, to bugs and kind of how bugs have been used in the military, to tanks and cannons and helicopters outside. We also have a piece of the World Trade Center from New York from the 9/11 attacks that's here. And if you stop on up too, we have a little bit of history up here for the 2002 Winter Olympic Games as well. So you can see the torch as well from those games up here at the stadium, and see where the athletes stayed in the athlete village.
Again, thanks to Bo Burgess, director of the Fort Douglas Military Museum. I hope you will stop in the next time you're in Salt Lake City. And who knows, maybe you'll run into 98-year-old Don Pullen, the Purple Heart veteran who makes those cutting boards for the museum's gift shop. We get to hear his story now, starting with his childhood memories growing up in Salt Lake City.
Main Street was just homes. And I lived on one called Grant Avenue. That's where I was born and raised. And my dad had his business right next to the mortuary. The mortuary is still there. And my dad had his garage business right next door. And it had an upstairs in it. And so after he got established there, why, they finished the upstairs and we moved in there. And I lived upstairs in that apartment house, I guess, until I was about 7 years old. I went to school, the Grant School. I had a good childhood, had a lot of fun. People weren't so fussy those days. If we cut across the lawn, they'd come out and holler, use the sidewalks, but they never bothered you. I remember the house that was right next to us. We'd get out there and have fun on their lawn, and they would get out there, and they'd holler, kids, play out in the street, but get off our lawn. We'd say, okay. So we'd move out on the street for about one or two plays, and we'd be back in on their lawn. Nobody cared. They weren't near as particular as they are nowadays. It was a fun way of life.
Do you remember as a boy having a dream, an ambition, a thought of, hey, someday this is what I'm going to grow up and do with my life?
No, the only thing I could think of was being a mechanic like my dad. My dad didn't know what it was to come upstairs and go to bed. Sometimes my mother would holler at him and she'd say, supper's ready. And he'd say, put it in the oven. I'm busy. And he'd stay down there till after dark.
Did your family feel the effects of the Great Depression or not so much?
My dad did. He had his business on the corner of 5th South and 2nd East on the northeast corner called the Day and Night Service. And that's the way it was with my dad. He would go to work and he may not come home for a day or two. He'd just stay right there. People come in and dad would work on their car and get it going for him. I remember they had a gas pump out there. It had the old handle on it. You'd pump up the gas. And they had a ring around the gas, and it would tell you what they had. So when a guy come in there, want a half a gallon of gas, you know, people didn't buy a tank full. They bought a gallon or half a gallon, but my dad had a big boring machine. He used to bore out the pistons holes and re-piston cars and rebuild them. And he used to take the Chrysler Motor Company to task on some of the things they'd do, and my dad had showed them how wrong they were. He made a lot of corrections. Then we moved out of there, and we went up to 7th South, right there just off the mortuary. And we had a second-story building there for us. And his garage was down below. And we'd walk to the Grant School. The Grant School is all gone now. It's got a big building on it. We'd play ball and so forth right out in the street, right straight in front of the old Deseret Mortuary. It's still there. He used to work on their cars. I remember one time distinctly, they had just put a body in one of their cars and parked it out in front. And my dad thought it was to be repaired. So he pulls it into his garage, and when he opened it up, he liked to die. That guy was in there, and, well, you know, pretty dead. And he shut the door, and he pushed it outside, and he told them to keep their bodies over there at the mortuary. Don't put them in his cars. I remember that one. I just grew up there, and we moved out on Downington Avenue, and I was raised there. I was living there when war broke out, and me and my buddy, Bill Christensen, we decided that we were going to whip the Germans all alone, so we joined the Army. Didn't last very long. We found out that the United States Army didn't agree with us deciding to take care of things. We had to do what they wanted done. Bill went one way, I went another, and Bill was killed. He was in the Pacific. I went over in Europe.
And we're going to hear more about that when we come back from 98-year-old Don Pullen of Salt Lake City, Utah, the unique unit he served with, the history that he witnessed, and also the close call that left him with a Purple Heart. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, CVTR.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 98-year-old Don Pullen of Salt Lake City, Utah. He served in World War II with the 9/11th Air Engineering Squadron. We're going to hear later on how he was wounded near the end of the war in Europe, but I didn't get a chance to ask you yet, Don, what you remember about December 7th, 1941, and how you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor as an 18-year-old, I guess, here in Salt Lake City.
I remember that there was a bunch of Japanese people right around us, and they were severely chastised. People wouldn't talk to them. If they were walking on the sidewalk in front of them, they'd throw rocks at them. And yet, it wasn't their fault. I mean, they didn't cause a war. It was a country, but people didn't think that way. They just, a Jap was a Jap, and that's all there was to it.
Had you gone to school with Japanese Americans?
Oh, gosh, yes. Some of the best classmates I ever had were Japanese fellows. I wish I could remember their names, but, you know, there's a lot of years between 98 and 12. We had a lot of friends like that. We played with a lot of them.
So you mentioned your friend, Bill Christensen. You mentioned you both decided to go in together, but that he was killed in the war. And, of course, you were wounded in the war. Yeah. But do you know what happened to Bill?
No, I don't. I wish I did, but I surely don't. When I wrote a letter to him, I told him I couldn't swim, so they sent me over to Europe. I had communication with him for, I guess, for about 6 or 8 months. But, you know, you could write a letter and it would take it 6 months to get there. But Bill was killed over there in that half of the world. And I got banged up at Kassel, Germany. I decided that the war was over for me, I think. So I stepped on this landmine and the damn thing went off.
I'm going to have to ask you more about that, but I want to hear about the early times in the Army. So you decide to go in. Do you remember what you thought Army life was going to be like, what your expectations were?
We never expected our life to be as, how shall we say, as stinking as it was, newly in. And so we were picked on. The guys had been in there for 6 or 8 months. We were just rookies, and they would just pound the salt at us, and we'd have to do all the dirty work while the other guys had their portion of the operation. We didn't practice shooting and killings and so forth as people would imagine, but we did picking up and hiding and digging in. Digging in the foxholes was the most prominent thing to learn how to do, because they told us that when we got over, we would probably live in foxholes. Well, we had no idea what a foxhole was until we started digging them, and then we found out in a hurry that a hole in the ground wasn't necessarily a good thing either. But we had them, and then we worked our butts off digging them, and then along would come a bomb and cover up the foxhole, and we'd have to start all over again.
Where did they send you for training here in the States before you headed over?
Down to California, Camp Tanforan. We were fenced in. We couldn't get out. You'd imagine that we were going to run away or something. And I remember when my dad got into, I guess you'd call it civil service now. But anyway, he was responsible for making all of the automobiles and everything else run during the war. And they wouldn't let him inside the camp. It had chain link fence all the way around it. So he stood on the outside while I stood on the inside talking to each other. And they'd only allow us to talk to them for a period of maybe 5 minutes or so. Then they'd pull you back in away from the fence, and that was your visit. It was a crazy way of life, but it worked out pretty good. We came out on top.
And you ended up in a fairly unique unit in the Army. How did that unfold? How did you end up in the 911th Aviation Engineers?
We had to service all of the transports. When a ship had come in and it was in bad shape, we had to overhaul it, put it back together, make it airworthy. They used to tell us, you get to take it first. If it works, then we'll take it. And lots of times the old ships didn't stay up very long. C-47s, that's just like the old airlines. They didn't last very long. It vibrated itself to pieces. But it was a good way of life as long as we were in the States. It was when we got over that it was crazy. We had English, God bless them. We never had anything like it. They had certain things they would do. We just fought them tooth and toenail. We didn't believe in that kind of crap, but it didn't make any difference. You didn't change them. They still stayed that way.
What would be an example of that?
At lunch, they would all quit what they were doing and go have lunch. And if we were digging a hole or taking care of something, we took care of that and ate lunch afterward. They couldn't understand how come we could do it. We just like went crazy with them, those people, because all of a sudden somebody would holler, "It's tea time," and everybody would stop and have a cup of tea. And we used to get so stinking mad if we were with any of the English at the time. We'd tell them to pour that stuff in the sewer and let's go to work. But after about, I'm going to say about 6 months or so over there, we learned to drink the tea as same as they did, because that was all you had for water. When somebody would say it's tea time, it was 10 o'clock. After you had lunch, if it was tea time, it was 2 o'clock. We used to think, geez, what a way to fight a war. It was crazy. They were wonderful people. I met some of the most wonderful people in the world over there. Their names, Charles and Catherine Christmas, and their son, Pat Christmas. And I used to think, what a crazy name. And so when I got home, I checked it. And Christmas is quite a common name. It was very highly thought of. And I thought, boy, here all this time, I thought the people were crazy. And they they had a prominent name in the books. But they were wonderful people. Dell and I were on top of a haystack, and we were watching the Germans go over. All of a sudden, this lady was hollering, "You damn Yanks! You damn Yanks! Do you want to get killed?" We looked over the edge of the old haystack, and here this lady was hollering at us, "Get down! Get down!" So Dell and I climbed down, and we went over to their home. I never will forget it. They had they called it a cupola. We called it a shed. They built a shed on the outside of their house where when they would go out or when they'd come in, they'd go in this place, shut the doors, and then open up the door to the house because there was too much light going out and they were afraid of having bomb problems right there. And Dell and I got so that we realized how serious these people were, because we went through several bombings and we lived with these people. When I say lived with them, we were sleeping on their floors. We thought there's got to be a way of thanking these people. I never will forget that. So we handed her 2 pieces, 2 and 6, which is roughly 50 cents. And she absolutely refused to take it. She wouldn't take it. So when we'd sat down the sofa in their house, we'd drop coins down in between the cushions and so forth. And then when she'd pick them up and she'd say, "Did you boys lose these?" Dell and I'd say, "Nope, we didn't lose them. It's not ours." And she'd say, "Well, it's not ours." And we'd say, "Well, losers, keepers," and told them that was theirs. If they found it like that, it was theirs. Even when I came home, when I was writing to them for some time before they ceased writing, we would send money over, because you couldn't imagine how these people had to live. Leastwise, Dell and I, we lived better in the army than they lived in civilian street. They always had a big pot of coffee on a hook hanging over an open fireplace. And so we'd go over there, and when she'd say, "It's tea time," she had a big dipper, and she'd dip it out of the pot and make a drinkable tea out of it. So Dell and I just couldn't figure them out, just how they could live like that. But boy, they sure did. There was more like that than there was otherwise. We had Pat Christmas. Pat was their son. And as soon as he was 14, now, not 16, 14, he joined the same thing as the army, and he'd had to go out and go practice and run and hide, fire a rifle at the German planes. It was quite an interesting and serious way of life over there, especially when we'd watch the Germans go over. You couldn't hit them in 100 years with a .22 rifle, even with a .30-30, but they would always sit there and shoot at them, and Dell and I'd say, wasting ammunition.
And where was this in England?
This was right off the coast. I'd say about a mile off the Dover coast. When we went across the channel, every villager lined the streets. We thought it was going to be a secret move. The only thing about secret about that was that we didn't know where we were going. But those people lined the streets, And there was no such thing as army formation. You couldn't walk down the street in a company because those people wouldn't put it. They'd just charge right into you to grab the guys that they were familiar with and give them a goodbye kiss and walk right with them. We had people walking with us right down to the coast when we loaded on the barges to go over. It was a sad day. And when I came home, after I was home long enough to should have had better sense, I got married, we had our firstborn, and all this time I was still writing to the Christmases. I sent them the first letter, but when we had our baby, I just wrote a big piece of paper, "It's a boy," and rolled it up and put it in the envelope and mailed it over to them. I still have the teddy bear that they sent, and we thought, how much would it cost to send that all the way from one side of England clear to the other side and clear across the ocean and clear across the United States? That cockeyed thing must have cost them $50. We wrote and told them that it was wonderful. We appreciate it. But please don't spend your money like that because it's hard. I sent, oh gosh, I guess I must have spent around about maybe $100 or $150 I'd sent back over to them because that $50 over here was just $50. But over there, that $50 was about $100.50. And so we made millionaires out of them. I remember Dad Christmas used to say, "We're the richest people in the village." And I told him, "Don't spend it all in one place." Well, they couldn't. They couldn't even, didn't have a store there to spend it in.
And you mentioned Dell a few times, but you didn't tell me who Dell is. Who's Dell?
Oh, Dell was one of my buddies on the Army. The Army used to say, you got to have a buddy. You got to have somebody with you. You can't go alone. So Dell and I buddied up all the way through. The only time I lost Dell was when I got hurt. They sent me to the hospital, and I never went back to my outfit. I don't know what they did with them. But once you get out of an outfit like that, you never used to get back into it. But it was a wonderful way of life. It really was. Even when we crossed the channel, soaking wet, the barge we was on was more underwater than it was on top because we were all soaking wet. When we got off on the other side, the first thing they said was, "Strip off your clothes and get some dry ones." We thought, now just where in the H are we going to get dry clothes from? There's no laundry. There's no nothing. So we just wore our wet clothes and let them dry on us because that's all we had.
So when you talk about this unit, the 911th Aviation Engineers, so you guys were mechanics on C-47s and other cargo planes?
Yeah, on C-47s, P-47s, we had all of them that we were maintaining. We'd watch them take off, and we'd count the number taken off. And then we'd count them coming back, and we could always tell our losses because of the counts. When they'd go over in formation. When they'd come back, they were scattered all over the sky. And we used to think, geez, which ones did we lose? And we'd wait until they come down. The guys would always try to come back to their home field, but they didn't always make it back. We used to think, too many lives, too much lost. But it was a way things were going to go. But we'd hang in there with them and watch them. And when they'd come back in, we'd immediately run right over to them, help unload, then ask them, who did we lose? Because they never come back to the same field again. I don't mean again. At that time, the next time, maybe you'd get one or two more back home. But usually, if a ship was lost or if they were forced down, they were down in some other field and you'd never see them again. They just disappear among the ranks where they were at.
And can you give us a taste for some of the specific things that you had to do on those airplanes? Were you working on engines? Were you patching aluminum? What kinds of things did you have to do?
I was supposed to have been working on engines. But the ships are so full of holes that anybody that could hold a riveter, why, they were the guys that patched up the holes. We used to think they shouldn't call these ships C-47. They should call them patchwork because there was a lot of them. That how they ever kept afloat, nobody ever knew because, some of them were just shot to pieces. We just hoped like crazy that the ships that we had and we were working on and the crews, we were just hoping that they come back. But I would say one out of every 10 ships landed someplace else. They didn't come home.
And we're sitting here in your house in Salt Lake City, and you told me in this house that you lived in before it was built, which is a story in itself, that you welded the railing on the front porch I just walked up. Is World War II when you learned how to weld? Is that something that you did in that outfit?
Yeah, if you didn't know how to weld, you learned in a hurry because they need them like crazy.
Well, we need to take our final break, but there's much more to come with 98-year-old Don Pullen of Salt Lake City, Utah. You can access photos related to Don's story at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Check out the info on the Fort Douglas Military Museum as well. And we'll hear about Don's most harrowing moments in Europe during World War II when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest, did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments. One of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Don Pullen of Salt Lake City, Utah. He's 98 now, but he was in his early 20s when he crossed the channel from England and came ashore at Normandy's Utah Beach just 4 days after the first Allied troops had landed on D-Day.
Everything was blown up. Cottages, homes, streets. There wasn't much left standing. Our outfit, we got into the wreckage and the pulling of guys. I pulled out more goddamn guys than you can shake a stick at. Out through the sides of the B-17s or the B-24s. The B-17s was the best plane I ever had.
So you would have to go to the crash sites and try to pull guys out? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, everybody did, not just us. The medics, God bless those guys, we'd pass one guy out and somebody would holler, "Medic!" And so we knew we had one that was still alive. They'd come over there and start patching him up, pile him up on the ground. When I say pile him up on the ground, we might have five or six of them laying out there waiting for an ambulance to come by and pick him up.
Where were you during the Battle of the Bulge?
I was right on the edge of it. We had no choice, but we had to get into it because too many guys were getting hurt. So many guys got killed there. There was no place to hide, very little place to run. That Battle of the Bulge was a bad situation because the Germans had made such a big push. Everybody on the outskirts of that push were all involved with it. It didn't make any difference whether they were medics or foot soldiers or what they were. Our infantry were about the best in the world because, boy, those guys took on the Germans like you'd never seen. And they pushed those Germans out. They pushed it where we couldn't go.
Well, and we're here in Salt Lake City, and there's plenty of snow on the ground. But everybody that I know who lived through the Bulge talks about how incredibly cold it was there. What do you remember about the weather and how you dealt with it?
It was so gosh damn cold that you could have a fire and you couldn't tell it was burning because you couldn't feel the heat off of it. And that's no joke. We burned everything we could burn. There wasn't any dry wood because it was all wet, you know, from the storms. But we broke up chairs and tables and doors, piled them up, and then we would put the wet wood on top, hoping it would dry it out enough so that we could keep a fire going. But it was a cold Jose, I'll tell you. And when they say the Battle of the Bulge, it was the truth because the Germans made that push. We thought we were going to be right in the middle of a mess. But once the bulge was over, there was never any more to it. From that time on, we went all the way through. We never stopped again. It wasn't quite that easy, but it was a lot better than it was a week before.
And I want to hear about, you know, when you stepped on the mine, but did you have some other close calls before that you look back on and you say, boy.
That was the worst one. I was at Kassel, Germany. Now, before I tell you any more, I was telling the story one time. It was at Woodford School, and this little girl came up and said to me, do you know what my name is? And I said, no, I don't. She said, my name is Kassel. I said, oh, that's interesting. Do you want to know why they named me Kassel? And I said, I sure do. She says, because my grandma lived at Kassel, Germany. We were going through Kassel, Germany. That was the last big push. After we went through there, the war was winding down. We went down through Kassel, a couple of us, and we were getting shot at, and we couldn't imagine what the devil was going on. So we got two guys on each side, one watching one side and the other watching the other. And when they'd see something, a rifle barrel or something sticking out, or in the shadows, they'd fire a shot at him. And if it was over your head, why, you'd freeze and move right up against the building. It was crazy. There was no rhyme or reason. Everything was pretty well gone, but we couldn't imagine what was happening to us. All of a sudden, our ammunition, our rifles were all disappearing, and we couldn't imagine what was going on. And then all of a sudden, we discovered that there was a German officer, and he was living in the cellar of this house. And he would come up, and he would steal stuff, ammunition, a rifle, a bayonet, something like that, and then he'd disappear. Well, we didn't see it, and he'd go downstairs, and he was hiding out in this basement. So when we got this kid up there, he told us what was going on. So we waited. So when this German officer came up out of the cellar, why, we nailed him. And when we got him, well, he had enough stuff stolen from different companies and so forth that he could have waged a small war. That basement was plumb full of ammunition and rifles, bayonets. This little kid knew all about it, but I was glad he told us, because if that German officer had gone wild, he could have hurt us. That was right there at Kassel. Crazy.
And when you stepped on the mine, did you know there were mines in the area, or were you just completely taken by surprise when it went off?
I didn't know there was any mines in the area. I just put my foot down, pow, and the damn thing went off. Didn't give you a second chance. So, yeah, I'm scars from, about here, clear on up like this, where it split my leg. It just got my one leg. This one here didn't hurt.
What did you feel in the moment?
Didn't feel a thing. It happened so fast. After the noise left, then I found out I couldn't walk. The medics come up. I never will forget the one. He said, hell, bud, you're not hurt. Get up and go. they had tied my leg up from my ankle clear up to here. And he said, you got to get to a hospital. So I went, got into an ambulance, and they took me over there. The old doctor looked at it, and he said, God, you'll do anything to get out of a battle. And I said, yeah, how much did I do? He said, almost lost a leg. They stitched me up. The leg still hurts, especially in cold weather. It tells me that it's still there, but it was crazy.
Was there anyone else with you when that happened?
There were three of us, but I was the only one that decided to look. I shouldn't have done that. I should have stayed with the guys, and I'd been better off. But you never know those things until after it's the Big Bang.
What were you looking at or for?
Crowds. More of them.
You're the only one who decided to look for them. If you had stayed on the road, this wouldn't have happened?
Yeah. Yeah, we were on the roads. We were clearing them out. They were hard to convince the war was over.
When the mine went off, and you said you got a scar from your ankle, you know, up almost to your hip there, have you ever thought about how different it could have been if maybe your body was turned a different way or the angle were different? Do you think that mine could have killed you if it were a few inches away?
I think if I had put that foot in front, I think I'd have been dead. The way it is, it caught me on the back. That's when it cut me up. I think I lucked out. I really do.
And did it knock you to the ground?
It didn't knock me to the ground. It blew me to the ground.
How often over the years have you thought about the guys who didn't get to come home?
When I first got home, it really got to me. I could see some of the guys, see some of them getting hurt. And I used to think, what did I do that was so good? There's just no way about it. If you don't get hurt, you're lucky. If you get hurt and you don't get killed, you're lucky. If you get killed, that's tough, Gutty. That's tough.
Yeah, you told me about your friend Bill, who you joined the service with, that he was killed in the Pacific.
Bill Christensen.
Have you ever contemplated what his life might have been like if he hadn't been killed in the war?
No, didn't give it a thought. The only thing I did is I went over and talked to his mother. I had two of my buddies, Bill Christensen and Van McNamara. Van, he was a gunner on a B-25, I'm not sure. Anyway, he had to bail out and the chute didn't open. The guys told me, you got to tell his mother. I said, well, okay. So I went over. Their name was McNamara. She was always called Mac. And so when I went over, don't ask me why, I called her Mrs. McNamara. And she says, you've come to tell me about Van. And I said, yes. How do you tell a woman that her son bailed out of a plane and the chute doesn't open? So I told her, I said, Van got killed when he bailed out. I figured that's all that's necessary. Yeah. Sometimes life sure deals a poor dealt, I'll tell you. I just lucked out.
Is that what it was? You think it was luck?
It sure wasn't skill. never knew when I was going to get it. I just thanked the Almighty several times when we got into some bad ones. But you never know. You don't know what's going to happen. You just keep on going, going and going and going.
What is it that keeps you going now?
Now, I'm too damn lazy to die. I lost my sweetheart. I've lost my son. My daughter, she lives in Syracuse. Her and her hubby put the lights in the window and put the wreath on the door. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had any of it.
I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. And thank you for telling us your story. When you think back over 98 plus years, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or you're most thankful for?
I just have to say, thank the Almighty for even letting me live this long. But sometimes I think maybe what he's doing, he's punishing me for being such a rotten character. When I go to bed at night, I just thank him for what I've got because there's no reason for it. Because everything, it just goes. Yet it just takes it, and that's it, all there is to it. Just thankful that I came home and married my sweetheart. That was a fast one. I knew her when she was in high school and when I left for the Army. Never left any ties. Never said, I'll see you again. Never said, drop dead or anything else. And when I came home, first thing I did was call her mother and said, can I talk to Ruth? And she said, she works at the Center Theater. I said, okay. So I walked down the street and I stopped there at that Center Theater there. And it was the most beautiful lady I'd ever seen. And I walked over to her the booth, and I said, "You remember me?" "Yes," she says, "you're Dawn." And I said, "Great. How about a date tonight?" She said, "I work until 10. I said, "Okay, I'll be right here at 10 o'clock. At 10 o'clock that night, I stood there at the door. 5 days later, we were married. I just couldn't take a chance on losing her to somebody else, so I married her. We were married for a long, long time, over 60 years. Can't believe it.
Well, Dawn, I'm so sorry. I just realized something I did not ask you about that I think is really important for our listeners to hear from you, because I read an article about you in the Deseret News that mentioned you witnessed another important element of history during your time in Europe. You saw firsthand the horrors of the Holocaust at a Nazi concentration camp.
The concentration camp was the worst thing I believe I've ever seen in my life. There was dead people laying all over the ground. When the guys came up, we gathered up over 200 dead just off the ground. The Germans were through. They were trying to find somebody to surrender to. And that was when we went into the concentration camp. You couldn't walk without stepping on dead people. And we counted over 200 dead. The people in there showed us the crematorium. The Germans would make the prisoners carry them over, and they would push them into the ovens, and they were burning them as fast as they could.
Did you have any idea what you were walking into when you went there? Did you have any idea what had been happening?
No, when we got into that concentration camp, we couldn't believe it. It would make you sick. You couldn't go around there. You'd heave up your guts because there wasn't anything left in it. I thought, how could man be so inhuman to man? How could they possibly do it?
It is a horrific chapter of history, but one that is so important to remember in the hopes that it never happens again. Quite a conversation today with 98-year-old Dawn Pullen of Salt Lake City, Utah. Maybe you'll have a chance to catch him sometime at the Fort Douglas Military Museum. You can even buy one of his handcrafted cutting boards there. I have a photo of those up for you at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. That's all the time we have for today, but thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.